tell from reading the case, the court can't really come up with something that's internally consistent. It's fairly arbitrary. Okay, so can somebody tell us about Hegel versus McMahon? Yes. This is Egajewski, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. There was another problem with the case from the defendant's standpoint. Why in Hegel versus McMahon should the plaintiffs not recover? Yes, and what case had said you had to be there at the scene of the accident in order to recover? Well, that's the sort of companion. These two cases are brought together at the same time. Oftentimes the court will have cases with similar issues, but there was a previous Supreme Court case, Washington Supreme Court case, in which they said somebody who wasn't at the scene of the accident couldn't recover. Mr. Zarprist? What's that? That's the case we're working on here, Hegel versus McMahon, but yeah. Well, that's a California case. Yeah, Ms. Barnes? I'm sorry. Actually, the case I thought maybe it's Gain versus Carroll Mill Company. Gain versus Carroll Mill, which is in the middle of page 92 on the right hand side. That would be the more recent case, 1990, and the facts of that case would be the plaintiffs, the father and the brother of these state troopers, of this state trooper, I should say, are watching television, see a news report about a state trooper who'd been struck and killed by this truck operated by the defendant. And they recognize the car as the one that their son or brother, as the case may be, operated. So they knew that this was the scene of the accident at which their loved one had been killed, and they said this emotional shock from seeing it on TV, they were virtually there at the scene of the accident, and the court's response to that was, no, virtually there is not there, you can't recover. So the defendants say not only is there no objective symptomology, but you weren't at the scene of the accident, and that is a sine qua non of being able to recover in cases like this. What does the Supreme Court say about that case? I mean, the Washington Supreme Court in Hegel versus McMahon. Okay. Okay, so they sort of split the difference here. In other words, you know, you could read Gain versus Carroll Mill to say you have to be at the scene of the accident when the accident takes place. You have to watch it taking place. Or you could read Gain versus Carroll Mill to say, well, you have to be at the scene of the accident, not necessarily witnessing the accident, not necessarily being there at the time, but you have to get there before things have really changed a whole lot. Now, again, what you could do is say, well, most of the time you have to be there. That's certainly one of our criteria. But if the other two criteria are really strong, that can sort of compensate for a weakness or absence of criterion number one. The court doesn't do that. It says there is a criterion. You have to be at the scene of the accident, either when the accident takes place or before significant change has taken place. And in addition, they say to recover you what? What's the other thing we talked about? Well, yeah, but the other, you said the defendant appealed on two grounds. What does that mean? Before, what would be if you take out the word objective, what would be symptoms of emotional distress? It's all subjective. So as opposed to something that is objective, it would be insufficient for the plaintiff to simply sort of self-describe these internal feelings. And the defendant says, in effect, how can I defend myself against a person who says, well, I feel this way or that way. I have a tough time responding to that. And so the court says it's insufficient to have merely self-reported subjective symptoms of emotional distress. You have to have something that is objective. Who supplies an objective evaluation or objective evidence of emotional distress? Yeah, doctor, psychiatrist, psychologist, might not be actually a doctor, although that's nice to have, but someone who is a trained therapist who has, you know, medical, psychological training. As I said before, that's a relatively modest standard to impose because, after all, who of us couldn't show up at a psychologist's office today and have someone make an objective diagnosis that we suffer from a variety of different psychological conditions, you know, anxiety, you know, procrastination disorder, you know, narcissism, you know, self-indulgence, whatever. You can just put a label on, you know, there are probably a couple of human beings in the world that you wouldn't describe as being emotionally whatever in some respect or other. And someone who's just lost a family member or someone who's just had their loved one horribly mangled in an accident goes to a therapist. The therapist, if you pick the right therapist, is going to be able to put a label on it, post-traumatic stress disorder or something else. So it's a relatively, it's not as though, oh, we dodged that bullet from the defendant's standpoint. All these plaintiffs who would come forward with these subjective symptoms of sleeplessness and nightmares and intrusive memories, that those people won't be able to recover. They just have to jump through the hoop of having some professional put a label on it. I've talked before about, you know, dialing 1-800-EXPERT to find, you know, there's a relatively well-oiled machine on behalf of plaintiffs who will, you know, for the right fee, testify on the plaintiff's behalf regarding, you know, whatever issue there is. Obviously, the defendant can challenge the credentials, the credibility, and so forth of the plaintiff's experts, but in terms of getting to the jury, that part of the requirement is relatively modest. The court still imposes this requirement that you be at the scene of the accident before significant change has taken place, but they don't say you have to actually witness it. So again, a jurisdiction could be more generous or less generous than this. A jurisdiction could say, well, being at the scene of the accident would be would accentuate the harm. But let's suppose they hadn't gotten there before he was put in the ambulance. Let's say he'd already been put in the ambulance and was on his way to the emergency room when they get there just at that moment. Or let's suppose they don't they actually meet him at the emergency room, and they watch as the doctors try to clean up, you know, work on him. And if you've ever watched these, whatever channel they're on, Discovery Channel or Learning Channel or whatever it is, where you get to watch what happens in an emergency room, oftentimes with a, you know, a gory stuff fuzzed out, sometimes not so fuzzed out, where you watch what happens in an emergency. It's pretty gory stuff. If that's your loved one that you're watching as they stitch up or try to, you know, and the loved one is barely conscious, in the last stages of losing consciousness or dying or what have you, a jurisdiction might say, well, that's not exactly like watching it happen, but it's close enough. Those memories, you know, we've got psychological testimony that says this, you know, memory of the emergency room is an extremely powerful, intrusive, post-traumatic stress disorder kind of memory, and we think that's close enough in view of the relationship between these parties and then so forth and so on. Let them take their case to the jury. So again, there's a lot of room here for, you know, depending on the perspective of the judge and the merits of a particular case, for the court to either move the line this way or that way to accommodate or close the door on somebody's case. And as the court indicates on page 94 in the right-hand column, the two-thirds of the way down, other jurisdictions, again, the court's kind of looking around and saying, gee, I got this whole menu of, cafeteria of different approaches to this. I guess we'll pick this one. Sort of middle-of-the-road kind of approach. And again, my purpose in giving you these cases is to show you that the courts struggle with these cases, and you should anticipate that in a case that falls somewhere in the middle, that a case can be made for recovery, but a case can also be made to deny recovery. And you should be prepared as an advocate for either approach. If it's clear that under the criteria adopted in Hegel or in Dillon, if it's clear that the plaintiff would be entitled to recover, you know, you can say with some degree of confidence, here are these, you know, the plaintiff was at the scene of the accident, the plaintiff's closely related to the victim, the plaintiff suffered this significant direct emotional shock, I think I've got a strong case. This plaintiff's probably going to get a bystander recovery. On the other hand, if each of those criteria is weak, for example, I gave an exam, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, involved a case of a, I think she was a 16 or 17-year-old working on a farm. And she's, what is she doing? She's processing seed of some kind, pouring these bags of seed into this thing or whatever it is. And there's a sort of feeding mechanism that takes this stuff in, and she gets the sleeve of her shirt caught in the machinery, and it sort of grinds up her hand. And she calls her boyfriend, who comes and takes her to the hospital. They later get married. Does the boyfriend have a claim for bystander injury? I wouldn't think so, because he wasn't at the scene. He got there. It's like Hegel versus McMahon. He gets there while she's still, you know, got this mangled up hand. But, you know, a mangled hand is different from the kind of grotesque injury that we've got in Hegel versus McMahon. It's not that, you know, somebody's dying here, bad injury, but Secondly, you know, the idea of direct emotional shock as opposed to, you know, it's not the witnessing of this thing. It's probably he. Anyway, and the third question, how closely related? Well, at the time, he wasn't related at all except as a friend. Later, of course, they, you know. So I'm not saying it's beyond the realm of possibility, but I wouldn't give that claim a very good shot at recovery. So, again, using the criteria to evaluate the claim, I think you could come to a sensible prediction, pretty good prediction. Most jurisdictions, this isn't going to fly, or in most jurisdictions, this is going to fly because it's such a strong claim. Okay, continuing on this same theme, on page 97, we have Rodriguez. And again, we're back now to the California trilogy here. Dillon versus Legg, Rodriguez, Borer. They all reference, well, at least the later cases all reference the previous cases to try to articulate some standard that we can agree upon and hopefully trial courts will be able to utilize as they rule cases in or out. Can somebody tell us about Rodriguez? Ms. Shoemaker, go ahead. Now, just on that point, this case was decided in 1974. Since then, one might imagine that all of the sort of reproductive technology, in vitro fertilization, all kinds of stuff that is now being done might have addressed that particular issue. In fact, there was an article in the paper this morning, I don't know if anybody saw it, in Spokesman Review this morning about a guy, it's sort of about people with disabilities and about a guy in a wheelchair, you know, the father of twins. And anyway, if you happen across the paper, you might take a look at it, sort of apropos here. But in any event, at this point, it was assumed he couldn't have children. Okay. And this is a bunch of procedural stuff here. A general demurrer is like a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. It essentially admits all the facts. It says, okay, plaintiff, I admit for purposes of argument that all the facts you plead are true. Nonetheless, it doesn't state a claim upon which relief can be granted. There is no legal theory that would support a recovery for you, even if all the things you claim factually are true. And again, the reason for that is that up until this point, California had said there is no such thing as a claim for loss of consortium by a wife based on injury to her husband. Now, what was the rationale for that? Whoever came up with that idea. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And what was the? This is also a classic case of overruling a previous precedent. And we've talked before, what does a court do confronted with a case it now believes was wrongly decided, or which, but for this precedent, the court would be inclined to go a different direction? How much deference does a court pay to previous cases? The principle of stare decisis, let the decision stand, is one that essentially says to a court, if you've adopted a rule and that rule has been followed for a long period of time, or for that matter, a short period of time, rather than simply changing your mind every time the membership of the court changes, you ought to sort of stick with what you have, unless there's some earth-shaking reason that you ought to change it. And again, you know, what qualifies as an earth-shaking reason or justification for overturning a previous case? So again, that sort of longer-term issue of how you address previous precedent. One of the things to bear in mind here, or one of the things to watch, is the way in which the court systematically goes through, well, what was this previous, what's the rationale for the previous ruling? And is there reason to think that the reasoning behind the previous case was flawed or has changed? You know, so that maybe precedents that were established at a time when you had horse and buggies doesn't apply when you have automobiles. Maybe a precedent when the only means of communication was newspapers isn't valid when you have cable TV and internet and, you know, wireless phones and so forth. So again, the question of how does a court, on the one hand, retain a stable body of precedent that people can rely upon, at the same time, how does the court recognize changes in the society or errors in previous reasoning that require them to say, well, yeah, we used to do it that way, but we're not going to do that anymore. Okay, so getting back, the rationale or the rationales underlying the refusal in this case to permit a recovery were what? What did the court use to justify its decision? Okay. And is that still a persuasive reason for refusing to grant the wife a recovery here? Why? Yes, essentially this one is inconsistent with Dillon versus Legg. In Dillon versus Legg, the injury was indirect to the mother, to the sister, but no one is suggesting that Dillon versus Legg was wrongly decided. If Dillon versus Legg is good law, then consistent with Dillon versus Legg, we can't deny a recovery to Mrs. Rodriguez because the injury was indirect. What else do we need to know? Or what else did the court...
The evidence of the loss of companionship in society was an involved conjecture since the value of the independent gift. And the
okay, the speculative nature of the damages. Well, let's just talk about that for a moment. Is that a good reason to say to Mrs. Rodriguez, gee, we wish we could provide you with a recovery, but after all, what you're asking us to put a dollar value on is this really speculative, hard to quantify sort of thing. Is that a persuasive reason not to give her a recovery? Why not? Yes, particularly the emotional. Now, There's some speculation in figuring out, you know, if I got run over by a truck, how many more years would I teach here, what would my salary be, et cetera. But that's a fairly, again, I, like Mrs. O'Shea, have a fairly easy, you know, economic measurement to do. But with respect to the emotional harm, what's it worth if you crush my left arm and I can no longer go bowling, or I can't water ski, or I can't do things anymore because of the injury to my left arm? What's that worth? Well, a jury puts a number on that, whatever that is. If Mrs. Rodriguez can no longer enjoy the same quality of relationship with her husband, the sexual dimension of their relationship, the other dimensions of their relationship where, you know, they used to take walks by the beach and now, you know, he's in a wheelchair. There are things he used to enjoy. Now he's got a bad attitude, let's say, because, you know, he's so depressed from the loss of all of these things that he can't do anymore. We have to put a number on that, but it's no different from the kind of stuff we do every day in a regular personal injury case. So if that's the reason we wouldn't give her recovery, that's no longer persuasive. What else? Again, this whole sort of floodgates argument. If we give Mrs. Rodriguez a recovery, what about, you know, what about children they may have? What about ex-wives that, you know, Richard might have? Or, you know, his mother or his sister or his, you know, brother? Where would it stop? We're on the, you know, we're on this slippery slope here. The toboggan's about to take off and the end of Western civilization is right around the corner. What's the answer to that? Yeah, hey, you know, I mean, there's no reason that once we decide this case, we would be bound to decide every other case in favor of the plaintiff. We're going to exercise our judgment. If we say the police can't search your trunk because you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the trunk of your car, it doesn't mean that the police can't search you if there's an emergency or if you consent to it. Or, you know, we'll draw sensible distinctions. Trust us here. We're not going to let this thing spin out of control. What else? And let's talk about that for a second. In what sense is there a potential here for double recovery? Yeah. And now, it's a little bit tricky here because he's injured at his place of work, and maybe there's a workers' comp exclusion for his recovery. But let's assume this was a garden variety case where somebody hit him in an automobile, or, you know, there's no workers' comp issue. Richard is a plaintiff, obviously, and Richard testifies about, you know, his the consequences of his spinal cord injury, his inability to be employed. Again, I think in today's world, 30 years later, we have many more opportunities for people who are bound by wheelchairs. We have probably one student a year who goes through Gonzaga Law School in a wheelchair. So, you know, it's not as though this is the end of the world. On the other hand, when Richard testifies about his injuries, his economic loss, his pain and suffering, and again, the inability to function as a husband in all of the package of ways that are frustrating to him, that he wants to be this husband to his relatively new wife, and, you know, he can't open the door for her, he can't do all these different things. So if that is presented in an effective and persuasive way, as we would anticipate the plaintiff's lawyer would do, the jury presumably is going to be generous toward Richard in allowing him to recover for his injuries, which will in part be, again, you know, I'm a pretty tough guy. I had a tour of duty in, you know, this thing, and, you know, I've been through a lot in my life. But what really haunts me is when, you know, I look over at Marianne, doing the dishes after supper or whatever, and I think to myself, my God, you know, what have I left her to? You know, a life of no children, no, you know. If Richard's presentation is, in effect, these are all the things I can't do for Marianne, and then Marianne gets up on the witness stand, and Marianne says, you know, I've been through a lot in my life, I've had a tour of duty doing this, whatever, and, you know, I can put up with a lot, but I look over at Richard in his wheel, you know, we've got this kind of potential, do we not, for the relationship to be counted twice. Richard gets to count the relationship for purposes of his damages. Marianne gets to count the relationship for purposes of her damages. And again, effectively presented, the jury would be moved to see this as a very significant loss. And again, the effectiveness from the plaintiff's standpoint is, if you're the plaintiff's lawyer and you play this right, the jury is essentially put in the position of either giving the plaintiffs a boatload of money, or the plaintiff's lawyer can say, well, maybe you don't think this is important. Oh, no, you know. The jury's kind of feels as though the only way they can express their sympathy or their identification, that they have a choice between being these hard-hearted bean counters on the one hand versus, you know, being sensitive and connected to these fellow human beings who are in this situation. Hey, I identify with you. The only way to do that is by giving the plaintiff a huge recovery. I may have mentioned this, the case of the sledding accident, I think, maybe not. There was actually near my house this hill that had it's a great sledding hill when there's decent snow, and these kids were out on a plastic raft of some kind, plastic sled thing, made by a company called Intex. It's like a $30 thing that you fill up with air, like a sort of an inner tube, but you don't have that annoying valve stem to poke you as you're sitting on it. Anyway, so these kids are going down this thing, but they're way out of control. A guy named Higgins, who lived in my neighborhood, pushed this kid out of the way, seeing that the sled would otherwise hit him. The sled instead hits him, and he receives a spinal cord injury not unlike the one that happened to Richard Rodriguez. The jury comes back with a verdict against the manufacturer of the sled to the tune of $7 million. So, you know, well-presented case. The guy's this heroic guy who literally put his body on the line, sacrificed himself to save this kid. And so, of course, the jury wants to say, we admire you, we think your damages are real, and he gets $7 million. That's not a, you know, shocking award. But again, the question would be, if his wife shows up and says, now I want my award, to what extent is she also entitled to a recovery, and to what extent do we have the potential for double recovery? What's the court's answer to that potential problem? Okay. Yeah. Now, Now, again, I think here the tort system has this potential to be do more harm than good. I mean, somewhat like the wrongful birth, wrongful life cases, there is a place at which one would hope that Marianne would say, when I stood before, you know, when Richard and I got all dressed up and stood before the preacher and our friends, and I said, you know, for better, for worse, in sickness or in health, you know, I didn't realize then, I mean, I said those words, but they didn't quite hit home to me until this happened, and now Richard and I are finding out that I do love him for better, for worse, you know, in sickness or in health. And, you know, I discovered things about myself and about my husband and about our relationship that, though I would never want them, I would never wish them upon myself or anybody else, you know, there are things, it's not all bad. Just by way of another digression, you may have read the case of Blake Pirtle, recently pled guilty to this double murder at Burger King out in the valley. The murder was committed about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, something like that. One of the victims, Danya Culbraith, 20 years old, who was the manager or the acting manager at the time that Blake Pirtle, coming down from his cocaine high, former employee at the Burger King, breaks into this place and then savagely murders Danya and this other young man who was working there at the time. He was sentenced to death, and then the sentence and the conviction were overturned by the Ninth Circuit, and rather than retry the case, the prosecutor negotiated a plea in which he pled guilty to two counts of murder and received two consecutive life sentences. Danya's mother is my neighbor, Diane Hartvigson, and we got to know them fairly well, and you can imagine how difficult it would be to lose your daughter in a situation like that. And the details of the crime are just almost beyond description. They're just but in any event, Diane acknowledges, you know, if someone ever gave me a choice, you know, could I have my daughter back? You know, I would do that in a heartbeat, but I have to tell you, there are things I learned about myself and about my faith that I never would have learned if it hadn't been for that experience. And, you know, in a strange kind of way, I mean, it's an ultimately sort of theological issue that, as Joseph said to his brothers, you know, when his brothers, when the identity of this family is finally revealed, you know, his brothers sell him into slavery, Joseph gets down to Egypt, is able to save lots of Egypt and his brothers and his family besides because of, you know, he said, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. And it's the mystery of how things that are not, no one would plan it this way. No one would say, hey, I know, why don't you sell your brother into slavery? Because I'm sure there's something good that'll be at the other end of that. You'd be crazy if you thought that. But there is this strange way in which, and again, to the extent that the court is pronouncing this relationship sort of DOA, rather than saying, hey, this is going to be challenging, it's going to be a struggle like Holly Caudill, you know, there may be some way in which you will discover new depths to your commitment to one another that you hadn't known before. But, again, that's a long aside from the fact that the court said, whatever you might want to say about that, there are two distinct injuries. There's the injury to Richard. We got to fairly assess that, make that award. there's an injury to Mary Ann. We got to fairly assess that and make that award. And we've gone through all the rationales that undergirded this previous precedent, and none of them survive our scrutiny. Moreover, there's this whole notion, there's this line here. I've seen it actually quoted more recently. The line about the common law treatment of marriage. My colleague, Mark DeForest, is actually writing an article on Blackstone and this whole concept of, it's on page 99 in the left-hand column, Blackstone's notion of what was called coverture, the sort of unity for legal purposes of the marriage. But this clever little quip here, in footnote one, at common law, the husband and wife were considered as one, and he was the one. Again, this sort of desire to move away from outdated notions about the relationship between a husband and wife and their legal status. So, again, all of this stuff by way of saying the court is not going to follow this precedent. It's going to acknowledge or recognize this right of the spouse to an independent right of the spouse to their own recovery. Now, I can only emphasize again the way in which we are treading on very difficult sort of treacherous ground here from the standpoint that how do you look into the future of a relationship like this? Any marriage is complex and hard to evaluate or you know, what have you. Again, to the extent that the jury is making these assessments and the defense has the theoretical right, but who would exercise that right to say, well, I heard, there's this evidence that Richard was already getting restive, he complained to his co-workers that Marianne was this and Marianne was that, and Marianne talked to her old friend from high school, and, you know, there was actually some talk that she had struck up a rather close friendship with the milkman, or, you know, whatever it is that where are we going to go there with that sort of evidence, and are we going to, well, again, we don't really have much choice except to make what assessment we can of how this was going to turn out. Now, the last chapter scene in this play here is Borer versus American Airlines, which again follows up on Dillon, follows up on Rodriguez. It seems like the trend line is you set up some previous precedent of limitation and then you then knock it down and say, go for the gusto. We're looking for new worlds to conquer here and new things for the tort system to do. So can somebody tell us about Borer? Yes, Mr. Christopoulos. Okay. And what's the plaintiff's basis for asking for recovery? Yes, it's essentially the plaintiffs in this case would say, we are all Marianne Rodriguez, in effect. We have a different relationship. This is okay. It's a different relationship, but there's still some similarity in terms of the fact that I have a close relationship, dependent. The harm to this person is a harm to me. Now, just thinking about this strategically, if you're the Trial Lawyers Association or you're the defense bar, you're plotting as interest groups often do. You know, if you've got a long-term strategy, whether you're the National Rifle Association or Planned Parenthood or the Family Research Council or the Sierra Club, you have an agenda about where you want the law to take you. And one of the things that you do is you strategize which cases in what sequence. So this is one of the things, by the way, Thurgood Marshall did very well before he became a Supreme Court justice. He was the head of the, NAACP, their litigation arm. I can't remember what that was called, or maybe it was still part of the NAACP. But anyway, Thurgood Marshall, from the time of the 1940s on, figured out, okay, if we're going to get civil rights acknowledged in the courts, we got to start here, we got to go there, we got to go. And the selection of Brown versus Board of Education to start with children in school being bused across town to avoid having black children and white children in the same classroom, that was a brilliant selection of a case to begin the process of overturning Plessy versus Ferguson and so forth. If you were the plaintiff's bar trying to figure out how do we expand the number of people who are able to recover for tort injuries, why is this the wrong case to pick? Mr. Lobach, what's that? Yeah. You've got a floodgates case here. You know, the old idea that if you want to take away somebody's roll of salami here, you don't try to take the whole thing. You say, can I just have this little slice here? You won't miss that one, will you? And you just take it a little slice at a time. This is, you know, a much bigger slice here. What else is wrong with this case from the standpoint of picking one that's going to have the greatest? There's nothing juicy in the facts here. You know, we don't have the pipe dropping on Richard Rodriguez in this, you know, very appealing or you know, evoking a lot of. A lighting fixture falls in Mrs. Borer, but we don't hear the details of this. She's not a single parent. If I were picking a case, I'd pick a single parent case. And, you know, with one child, let's say if I could find a child with special needs or with a disability. And the child says, you know, I used to come home after school every day, and there would be my mom waiting for me with a plate of, you know, warm cookies and a cold glass of milk. And now mommy's in a fog because of the painkillers, and mommy doesn't even know who I am. We can work with that, you know, again, make it really hard for the court to say no to this kid. Instead of which, we pick a case in which we have 9 children, 9 plaintiffs, but we're moving from Mrs. Borer's claim to 10 Borer claims. We've multiplied the number of plaintiffs by 10. We don't have anything that's really juicy about the facts here to make it hard for the court to do it. So what does the court say to the children of Mrs. Borer? Okay, and do they say these particular facts don't justify a recovery, but we're not suggesting that there is no case where a child could recover from parents? No, they don't say that. They say, as a matter of law, children can't recover for loss of consortium with their parents. It ain't going to happen. They draw a very bright line here. Now, they could have said something like, on these facts, blah, 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 but there may be a case out there that would tug at our heartstrings. They simply say, it's over. Now, that's the majority's view. What do the dissenting judges say? Yeah. So, I mean, there's a rather obnoxious technique that some lawyers are tempted to do and sometimes may do. When a witness gives inconsistent testimony, you know, at their deposition they thought they were going 40 miles an hour, but now at trial they say, no, I think I was going closer to 30. You know, the lawyer badgering the witness may say, well, were you lying then or are you lying now? And, you know, the dissent is sort of saying to the majority here, were you lying in Rodriguez or are you lying now? I mean, same criteria, but they yield one result for Rodriguez, they yield a different result for Borer. Where's the consistency in that? On the other hand, in defense of the majority, or to throw rocks at the dissenting opinion, what does the dissenting opinion offer by way of a dividing line here? If we're going to let the Borer children recover, how about the nieces and nephews? How about the kid, you know, there's a kid in this family of nine, let's suppose. This is a, you know, obviously they have... a very lively household. They have friends. There's always room for one more. There's a kid who's been living with them because that kid's parents are sick or going through problems or, you know, there's some other reason this kid's been living with them for a year and a half. Does that kid get to recover? Oh, no, only the flesh and blood relatives here. Well, by what criteria, if we're not going to draw this arbitrary line here, if we're not going to draw the line here, does the dissent tell us where they will draw the line? The dissent says, we can't tell you where that line is. It just shouldn't be drawn here. And I guess my analogy, thinking back to my earlier days of parenting, when the kids are just completely tuckered out, you know, they're 2 or 3 years old, and they're so tired that they're in that cranky state where nothing seems to make them happy. Well, you can entertain them for a while, and then they sort of laugh. But the impulse, certainly of my parents and my impulse as a young parent was, you know, the kid's going to cry. It's going to be unpleasant, but we might as well have them cry and be unpleasant at 7 o'clock and get it over with. Than to humor them till 9:30, spend 2.5 hours going through this, you know, sort of like pulling a Band-Aid off, you know, one hair at a time, but just sort of rip it off and get it over with. So the majority in this case is sort of saying, well, look, you know, we're just sort of prolonging the agony here. The dissent can't tell us where this is going to end. Wherever we draw the line, it's going to be painful. It's going to be arbitrary. We're going to rule some people in and some people out on some arbitrary criterion. We're going to look bad. We might as well do it now. And again, I give you these cases not to say, oh, this is a very sensible decision, and not, I certainly hope, not to induce a sense of cynicism. The courts are just, you know, it's a random sort of dartboard here that the judges throw darts at the thing, and whatever comes up, that's how they decide it. But to show you how difficult it is and how, in order to just get the thing resolved, courts will wind up drawing a line in a place you might not necessarily think would be defensible. That you would think, oh, they couldn't do this and that. Well, yes, they can. And just watch. They do. So, particularly in these areas where you have competing policy considerations, again, looking at this from the standpoint of Mrs. Borer, as a Mrs. Borer is entitled to her recovery. Remember that Mrs. Borer can, if she wants, in fact, Mrs. Borer should emphasize in her damages her inability to be a good mother to her children. If, in fact, the children are suffering because mom, who used to be the centerpiece of this family, mom, because of this injury, now has to take these heavy painkillers, and there are days when she doesn't even recognize her own children, much less can she, you know, take them places and cook and clean the house and organize the chores and, you know, read stories to the kids and counsel the older ones and do all the things that, that mom was doing. Theoretically, when she testifies and asks for a recovery, the jury can be generous, or they can compensate her for, in effect, the loss to her children. And of all people, we ought to trust, in effect, that the compensation to Mrs. Borer will find its way to the children. We ought to be able to trust Mrs. Borer. That if the kids have suffered, she will get the compensation. She will use that compensation. Well, I can't read the kids' stories anymore. I can't take them to their violin lessons. I can't, you know, be there at the soccer practice, but I can take them all to Disneyland. Or I can hire, you know, I can order, we can have somebody, you know, pick up takeout at the Chinese place, and we can have you know, a family dinner. I can't cook it, but at least, you know, we're not, people aren't going to be eating, you know, peanut butter and opening a can of soup every night and fending for themselves. So, again, in theory, we can do it by compensating Mrs. Borer. Does that same rationale apply in the Rodriguez case? Should we go back and reconsider Rodriguez and say, no, Marianne doesn't deserve a recovery? Richard will, if in fact this is such a devoted couple, Richard should be counted on to take his recovery and be generous toward Marianne. Is that a similar kind of situation where we should rethink a separate recovery for Mrs. Rodriguez? Should we go back and reconsider Dillon versus Legg? I don't know. Stop asking me these questions. Again, the whole thing is such that if anybody had a magic bullet here to say, oh, here's the principle, the golden thread that runs through all this, here's a way to make it all a nice, consistent whole, the right people will get recovery, will be able to say no in all the right circumstances, defendants will have an appropriate limit to their liability, but plaintiffs who really deserve the compensation will get it. Here are the set of principles you ought to follow. Nobody's come up with that. If you were able to do so, the world would, as they say, beat a path to your door. Yeah?
The fact that spouses can recover and children can't, is that kind of a jurisdictional thing also, or is that...
Yes. You know, it is. That is a jurisdictional thing. I would say that it is... I think I can say universally, I know of no jurisdiction that would not give a spouse a right to recover. The idea of loss of consortium for the spouse, I think if it's not universal, it's at least the vast majority of jurisdictions. By contrast, the treatment of children, whether it's parental consortium with children or children's consortium with parents, I think maybe I mentioned here, maybe I don't, it happens that Washington has a statute authorizing a recovery by parents for loss of consortium with their children in the event that the children are injured or killed. So, in the event that your child is injured, the parent has a right by statute for a recovery. So, in effect, the legislature has answered whatever reservations the court might have had. Well, it's right there in the statute. A legislature could fix this. Legislatures typically don't because they don't really have a clear mandate or a clear bright line to offer either. They let the courts kind of work this out as best they can. Mr. Mitchell? No, not in the case. The particular statute in Washington that has to do with loss of consortium is general. I had a case, trust me on this one, because I had a case involving a girl who was out at the Air Force Base who... it was actually a Federal Tort Claims Act case, but it relies on the law of Washington for the basis of recovery. It's a wintry day. They're going to the bowling alley on the base. The girl sees this a puddle of water. She's 8 years old at the time, and just sort of, you know, testing out this a puddle of water, sticks her foot in. It turns out it was a steam tunnel that had... ruptured in some way, and this was 190 degree water that she put her foot into, horribly burned her foot, about 6 surgeries, et cetera, et cetera. Well, she's the primary victim. She's entitled to recovery, but in addition, her parents had a claim for loss of consortium, same concept that, gee, the relationship to my child has been injured because my kid's no longer this happy, you know, cuddly kid. I'm wheeling my kid in and out of surgery. So, again, there's a statutory basis. How do you assess the damage to the, you know, the jury does the best they can in making that assessment. Yeah. Well, they have to be a child. That is, yeah, right. And, right. Right. Oh, that's right. So there's a provision where the parents can recover for loss of consortium with an adult child if the parents are financially dependent on the child, oddly enough. Okay. In any event, so again, you could by statute fiddle around with this stuff, but most legislatures don't touch it because they don't really have much to contribute. Mr. Nelson. Yes, that's right. So if a child wants to recover for loss of consortium with a parent, there's no statutory authority for it, but there is some common law support for it. It turns out there are cases that say, in the right circumstances, you can recover on a sort of Dillon versus Legg kind of basis. So again, my advice for you in terms of the exam, I keep coming back to that, looking at the exam, what you want to do is, again, evaluate the case from the standpoint of saying, if I'm the defendant trying to figure out who's going to show up at the cashier's window and what kinds of damages are they going to claim, I need to evaluate not only the immediate victim, but who else is going to line up and how convincing will their case be in looking for additional compensation. And I make that evaluation or similarly from the plaintiff's standpoint, if I am a related party, I need to evaluate the likelihood that I can recover. Okay, why don't we take our 10-minute break and we'll come back and start Section C.